Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So this evening, doing the chanting, as usual. Every once in a while, I actually pay attention to the chanting. I mean, you do it. I mean, it's sort of so ingrained. I've been doing it for over 40 years, and every once in a while, something really sort of leaps out at me, and it's really good stuff. That it's one of the. Of course, say the theme of the whole retreat, trying to use mindfulness, four foundations of mindfulness. So actually being mindful of the chanting. But that, I think it's the case. It's the way it works in the human mind. But from time to time, that something leaps out, and for me this evening it was just refuges, that sense of to the Buddha, to the Dhamma, to the Sangha, I dedicate this body and life, and it's really on a certain level you say, wow, that's really extreme, because kind of the human condition and a tendency, especially in a modern culture, you don't dedicate your body and life to much of anything other than yourself. really consciously, you're reflecting on that, Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, these are the traditional refuges, and that sense of a commitment. I think it's useful to really reflect on, what are we? What kind of commitments do we make? What kind of commitment do we have? How do we use it as well? Because you can use a commitment to make yourself feel guilty, or make yourself feel inadequate. I mean, there's all sorts of ways that we can do it. But that isn't the point of the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. It's like in the chanting as well. They say the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, they're sorrow's destroyers, and they bestow blessings on me. That's really beautiful. That recollection. That's the whole function of these refuges, is to destroying, overcoming, freeing oneself from all the different manifestations of dukkha, of suffering. And recognizing that, of course, we can do it. And these are the things that all the things that the Buddha taught are all things that we can actually do. I mean, in the sense that reflecting, and the Buddha actually says, if I didn't think you could do it, I wouldn't teach it. And I didn't think you could overcome suffering, free the mind from the defilements, I wouldn't teach it. But it can be done. So that relying on these refuges, and relying on the practices that we have to give an opportunity for ourselves to free the heart from its tendencies of creating suffering, and just reflecting on what the that commitment to, well, commitment to anything, but particularly in terms of our spiritual practice, recognizing that we have this opportunity to make a commitment to a training, to precepts, to virtues, to integrity, to wisdom, to awareness, and that's recognizing. You know, and sometimes the, you know, the idea of it is one thing, and then the reality is another. You know, so the idea of committing, making commitment to a training, or to a practice, you know, there's the idea of it, and you know, it's a nice idea, a good thing to do. Yeah, logically, who wouldn't want to be free from suffering? And then there's a reality. And then all the stupid things that we do to create obstacles for ourselves or create difficulties or get entangled in the habits of mind that we have. So that that re-establishing, recommitting ourselves to these principles, these fundamental principles of Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. And they're kind of a means for encouraging, uplifting the heart. And I think also just really seeing, yeah, we're making choices all the time. That sense of making a commitment is helping to foster those choices. Like really make a commitment to awareness rather than unawareness. It seems like it would be, you know, a simple choice, but of course that's what the training starts to reveal, and as we make a commitment to awareness, and you starts to highlight areas where we get caught in unawareness, where we're not clear, we're not sure, confused, caught up in a mood, caught up in a bias, caught up in an obsession or something, something or other, and sometimes it's not at all clear in the sense of, so what do we do? And that's where, okay, this commitment to Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, it's more of a heart commitment rather than an intellectual, kind of rational. And that's why I say that that's where the, say like the chanting, it's like a devotional exercise, learning how to kind of exercise the devotional muscle and then, you know, get that working. And I think that's something that's easily overlooked, because sometimes we think we can actually think our way through everything, or that we can actually, if only I understood it, you know. And if I had a good idea about it, then it would sort of all become clear. Well, that's not necessarily true. And even if it were, would it even matter? You know, in the sense that, because if there isn't that kind of commitment and a kind of a sense of a real kind of maybe a strength of conviction, a strength of commitment, a willingness to just give oneself to something. Because that's, again, sort of the difference between idea and reality that can be miles and miles apart. Yeah, so there's this reflection on Buddha Dhamma Sangha, reflection on commitment, paying attention to how we can help to incline the mind, incline the heart to the things that really do provide a refuge for the heart. Saturday night, Abhayagiri. it's a big help. It's a coming together and just meeting in silence, learning how to incline the mind, incline the heart toward silence, learning how to appreciate silence. You know, that's something that it goes against the grain, it goes against the habit, and sort of in ordinary social discourse, you meet with somebody or meet in a group of people, and the compulsion to engage is so strong. It's uncomfortable to sit in silence with other people. That's what most people feel. I can't remember what the average length of silence and quiet that it's measured in. I mean, almost measured in milliseconds, I think. but sometimes it might work up to seconds. But people are uncomfortable. So silence, learning how to be in silence. Because it's that inclination to silence is like an inclination to awareness. I mean, it's a way to foster that inclination to awareness and appreciation of silence, learning how to allow the mind, allow the heart to really settle. And of course, the silence has to be coupled with attention, awareness, clarity of mind, and it's a big support. It's a big aid in helping to accomplish that. Yeah, I mean the tendencies within the culture are tends to go in an opposite direction. What is it that fosters the spiritual qualities and spiritual aspirations that, you know, I think that's inherent in the human condition, but is so easily overlooked, and the cultural values that we're in, sort of American culture, is actually it's a very Protestant culture, historically, so that it values kind of more of a kind of a action or ethics of engagement, and so it doesn't value the things of silence of the heart. It sort of has to be measured in order for it to be valuable. And of course, historically it's more of a Protestant culture. Toward the modern end of things, it's more of the same secular humanism, but it's still conditioned in that same way of action. So I think a spiritual aspiration has to be nourished and tended to. And certainly, I say like a traditional Buddhist culture, places a high value on the ability to be, say, still or to be pure, which is sometimes a loaded concept. And that's, I mean, it's really, to me, it's really interesting in the sense of, say, like a generally in, say, like in Thai culture, there have got to be some of the most socially gregarious people on the planet, but there's a value that is given, an appreciation that's part of the culture, and it's really interesting. So that for us, we need to reflect on it more, especially being in a Western culture, being in an American culture, we have to reflect on it and pay attention to how do we nourish that commitment to Buddha Dhamma Sangha? How do we nourish that commitment to a spiritual aspiration? It has to be a bit more conscious, a bit more overt. And certainly the drawing close to others who are practicing, drawing close to others who are hold similar values. It's kalyana mitta. It's very important. It's good spiritual friendship. Drawing close to sangha, a community that is overtly cultivating and practicing. It's a supportive condition. And you know, and obviously one still, even if you're in a monastery, you still have to deal with the human realities of everybody being different and not always complying with your wishes, not always fitting into your idea of what you think they should be. So that's just part of being human. But then using the practice to take those conditions and you know, how do we use them to cultivate? How do we use it to develop our practice? Learn how to foster awareness and to relinquish unawareness. Learn how to foster wisdom and relinquish delusion. Master Hua gives a well-known sort of saying of his. He used to use it to accord with conditions without compromising principles. No, and that needs to be reflected on and unpacked. And so that sense of according with conditions, you know, learning how to adapt and be agile, be flexible within conditions, because conditions are always changing. But without compromising principles, in the sense that it isn't just go with the flow, whatever. there are these principles of Dhamma that we have to rely on, and to not compromise them. It's like, you know, one has to rely on our kind of study of the teachings. We have to rely on the practice, learning how to implement them, our experience. But there are these fundamental principles, like the having a good grounding in the fundamental teachings. Ajahn Chah would oftentimes emphasize just put the books down, just practice. And sometimes people sort of take that and put all this effort into practice, but then haven't really studied to understand what the principles actually are. But then Ajahn Chah also, because oftentimes we pick and choose. What the Buddha says, we'll pick and choose things that, or say, well, things that Ajahn Chah says, we'll pick and choose the things that fit in with our bias. But so Ajahn Chah, because also Ajahn Chah saying, I said, like somebody who's a, they want to be a doctor, so they, there. But they don't want to go through all that. That's a long period of study, so they just sort of put up a sign and say they're a doctor. And just do the practice. And that doesn't quite work like that. It's kind of scary. So that, that it relies on studying and knowing the fundamental principles and then putting them into practice. And then in that putting into practice, one learns how to accord with conditions. And there's a phrase that I oftentimes bring up and emphasize. It's Dhamma or Dhamma Patibhata. Practicing Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma. And sometimes which actually this is one of the conditions that the Buddha lays down for stream entry. So it's very important. How do we practice Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma? And that's where one has to then pick up the principles and some of the actual fundamental teachings or some of these lists that seem to be so boring and onerous sometimes. Those are really important to check as kind of checklists or as a framework for, these are Dhamma principles that one can be engaging with, whether it's in terms of engaging in activity in the world or engaging in one's own interior cultivation and practice. One can use these sets of Dhammas to reflect on. Does this accord? Am I compromising principles? Or how do I uphold principles? Sometimes that's casting it into an actual aspiration or positive light. How do I uphold these Dhamma principles? So, just one way of looking, because there are many, many teachings or collections of principles. But one really good one that I feel is really important is the 10 paramitas. These wholesome qualities, basis of skillful conduct, beautiful conduct, that is one of the, say the etymological root of the word parami, is something that crosses over, that allows one to cross over. It's like crossing over from unawareness to awareness, crossing over from samsara to nibbana, crossing over from confusion to clarity. So it's a qualities that allow one to help cross over, they uplift the mind. And there are 10 of them, dana, generosity, sila, integrity or virtue, nekamma, renunciation, panya, wisdom, discernment, virya, effort, energy, kanti, patience, patient endurance, satya, truthfulness, truth, holding to truth, adhitana, determination, metta, loving kindness, and upekkha, equanimity. And these are, they're like a skill set. You've got these qualities that you can be, depending on the circumstance that one's in, one can be picking up a particular quality, and it accords with principles of Dhamma. Using a particular wholesome quality to apply to certain situations. And then sometimes where you're being feeling really challenged, or maybe something that's bringing up a lot of aversion and ill will, and then you sort of think, I should have more metta. And sometimes nice idea, but it's just not happening. But then you sort of realize, I've got these other qualities that I can rely on. I can rely on, patience, that's another one. Or I can put forth effort. So the metta is not happening, but I can put forth effort in at least trying. So that there's, and you should realize, it's something to delight in. Okay, I'm putting forth that effort, or you're in a situation where you're feeling, really shaken or stirred up and for something. Yeah, and equanimity is not happening. But yeah, there's other qualities that one can be directing one's attention to. You know, the renunciation, highly undervalued parami. Yeah. I think one is just the word itself is. I mean, the word is nikamma in Pali. And of course, all of these qualities are qualities that brighten the mind. And there's a feeling with, say, renunciation, that they're losing out somehow. But that's not the purpose. That's not the purpose or not the feeling. But I think maybe, I don't know how to translate it in a better way, but it's more like a... it was more like talking. It was being in a situation where one can exercise restraint and feel really good about it. And that's renunciation. Like, what's it feel like to go into, say, Costco, you know, or Safeway? But Costco's a really... I'd only heard about Costco's for a long, long time, when I first came to America. I think I lived in America for about 10 years before I got taken in for the quintessential American experience of going into Costco. But I said, like, you know, what's it feel like to go into Costco and go to the area where you actually just need one thing or two things? And you go in, and you get those one or two things, and then you just go out. And what does that feel like? It's a real sense of accomplishment. No, so that's renunciation. You know? That's the feeling of renunciation. I was able to restrain myself, and that feels good, yeah. Or be maybe for us going into Friedman's. We'll be coming back with the one tool that we actually need, with the one part that we actually need. there's a real value to that renunciation, or there's that sense of, well, nekama, because that. Because it is, it's a barami, it's something that makes one feel really good. It helps clear the mind, it inclines the mind to awareness. Of course, all of them are like the dana, the generosity, giving, sharing, helping, being of service, being able to give of oneself. It just feels good. Sila is similar, I mean, there's that sense of, like renunciation is kind of loaded with assumptions, keeping precepts, being virtuous, being good. But it's you know, it's not sort of getting getting oneself wound up in some Manichaean concept of good again versus evil. It's just that it feels better to do something virtuous with integrity. Than it does to harm or to take advantage of or to be inconsiderate with, be cruel. It just has a different feeling. But making it conscious is really important, because sometimes we don't even notice, especially if we're practitioners, oftentimes we don't even notice really when we're keeping precepts, being virtuous. Because it starts to become quite second nature, but it's really helpful from time to time to really recognize that, I haven't killed anybody today, and I haven't really stolen anything. Ajahn Kurundamo brought that up last week. But this is really, on the general level of in a population of 7 billion, that's really good, and it's oftentimes not noticed. Uh-huh. So it's really important to recognize. And then paying attention to what it feels like. And that sense of being able, because that's the Buddha, when he asks, you know, what is, you know, what's the benefit of virtue, of sila? He says, non-remorse. It's a very practical, because not remorse and regret, not that, it just is, it keeps the mind churning. So that inclination, the fostering of the supports of awareness rather than unawareness, the fostering of clarity rather than confusion, and the fostering of a letting go or relinquishing. Because that's the function and purpose of this, the Buddhist teachings, is to give us the opportunity to let go, to put down the burden of the complication. And that's one of the things that the Buddha, and he says, so, you know, what is this Dhamma for? It's for non-complication. It's keeping things really clear, keeping it really simple. Not making it complicated, convoluted, cluttered. As we clear out the clutter of our hearts, you start saying, well, then there's really not much of a choice, you know, in the sense of, it feels better to be happy rather than to be miserable. It feels better to be peaceful rather than to be confused. It feels better to be kind rather than kind of churlish. And when there's a clarity there, it isn't really a choice. It's really what the heart wants to do anyway. So it's giving ourselves an opportunity to abide in these refuges, to really take that commitment and fostering that opportunity to experience, to taste, to abide in these things that, from the Buddhist perspective, these are refuges. It's this opportunity to take refuge in something that's ennobling and is peaceful, is secure. Those are all epithets of Nibbana, the secure, the peaceful. And the non-complicated, so reflecting on refuge. So I'll offer that for reflection this evening.